Support for the Pitch Talks podcast provided by the good beer folks at Steam Whistle, makers of Canada's premium Pilsner. Why not stop by the brewery before or after the game for a sample or a six-pack? Hey, everybody. Homestand Sports presents Pitch Talks. Today on Pitch Talks, we head down south. It's freezing out there, so let's set the controls for warmer climbs. We're talking Latino ball today on Pitch Talks. Thanks for checking out the podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Hilliard. Traditionally, baseball has been thought of as pure Americana and apple pie, all wrapped up in a horsehide cover. But there's a long and rich history to the game in Latin America. Baseball has been played in Cuba, the Dominican, and throughout Latin America since the late 1800s. Sure, today's major league lineups, and teams in the minors for that matter, are filled with Latin players, but that certainly was not always the case. The racial divide in America kept Latino players out of the majors for decades, but that didn't stop the development of their own winter leagues. There, teams were filled with not only Latin American players, but athletes from the old Negro leagues, and even some white players from the U.S. Recently, Jose Bautista's article for the Players Tribune, a link to which can be found in the show notes, turned a lot of people on to exactly what goes into developing Latin kids through their teens and finally into major league talent. Now, it isn't always pretty. And even if the kids do beat the odds and actually make it to the majors, there's always talk in the media of Latino players not playing the right way, whatever that means. Today on Pitch Talks, we take a deeper look into baseball in Latin America, the journey that Latino kids have to take to the majors, and the hurdles and flat-out stereotyping and racism that players have to face head-on in the media today. The Toronto Star's Morgan Campbell, who you'll hear first, and ESPN Deportes' Arturo Mercado took the stage live at Pitch Talks in Toronto and talked Latino ball.
Arturo, because I know you really know the history of the Latin American leagues. Talk to the audience about how the pre-1947 leagues in Latin America, you know, were almost like a World Cup of baseball for the type of talent, you know, they're able to attract from these different demographic groups.
Yes, because, well, baseball has been playing in Cuba for a long time, in Mexico, in Dominican Republic, in Venezuela, in Puerto Rico, in Panama. And in those years, they were able to combine the best talent. They were star from the Negro Leagues going to play winter ball. They were the local Latin players, some of them white, some of them black, who were there. They were also white American players who went to play winter ball or to play in the Mexican League. So the quality of these leagues were amazing, like, because those were the only leagues who really, by that time, were combining talent from everybody. But that was there was a lot of tension in those years. But the quality was great. Like, Cuba was winning all the World Cups, the International Baseball World Cup. Venezuela even won three of them. And even they were playing spring training in Panama. They were playing spring training games in Cuba. There is a story about when the Dodgers signed Jackie Robinson, that the Dodgers decided to play spring training in Cuba just to avoid problems in Florida. And the thing was that people were... That was the end of the Winter League season, and the stadium was full watching the Cuban game. When that game finished, and then you if you wanted to see the Dodgers game, you have to stay. Nobody stayed. They could care less about the Dodgers. Like, they were there just to watch their teams, their winter ball. And that's something that is so difficult for MLB to understand. And these leagues are very important for baseball. That's the way they are introduced to the game. That's the way they start liking the game, feel passionate about the games, and then they become MLB customers. But I don't think they still understand that. The Venezuelan Winter Ball League started in 1946. Actually, Jackie Robinson was playing in Venezuela in 1945, December 1945, when he got the message that he was going to sign with the Dodgers, so he had to leave Venezuela. He was there with a group of Negro League stars like Roy Campanella, and Campanella stayed for the first season of the Venezuelan Winter Ball, and probably Jackie Robinson would that too, but he didn't, because he had to go to the U.S. But Latin Winter Ball offer a great opportunity to develop players, and that's been the case for many, many years. Even before free agency, it was also an opportunity for MLB players to get money. They were making more money playing Winter Ball than in the Major League Baseball season. But with free agency, everything started to change. Teams started to get more control over the players, over the contract. There's more money involved. And what is happening right now is that even if you're a Venezuelan and you finish your minor league baseball season or your major league baseball season, you cannot go and play in Venezuela. You need a special permission from MLB that will allow you to go back to your country to play winter ball. And I'm talking, you can see the case in the major with the major league players, because it's really a long season. But the minor league players, they need that money. They are making no money in minor league ball, so they need that extra income by playing winter ball. And sometimes MLB will say, you cannot go there. It's the same case with Dominican players and Mexican players and Puerto Rican. So those leagues are struggling now. And even though they could be a great asset for MLB, but the way they approach that business, it's not the right way. Well, the way it works in the signing process in Latin America, and there is a big important day, July the 2nd, for the signing of Latin American talent that is coming now, is that these kids are training as professional baseball players since they are 11 or 12. Most of them have to give up education just to play baseball. And that they are under control of some people who are called buscones or independent trainers. Then they will sign when they're 16. But those deals are closed when they are 15, more or less, because that those deals happen a year before they are formally signed. And the Winter League teams cannot be involved in that process.
Right.
Because that would be the case like the Japanese team.
Yes.
They are forbidden to do that. They cannot do it. So MLB only negotiate with these players. They are free agents, in quotation, because there's a lot of limitation on the way they sign these players. And they deal directly with these buscones. And these buscones get a big percentage of the signing bonus of these kids. And out of 100, only 2 make it to the majors. 98% of the players who sign each July the 2nd will fail. And the system works because this kids are all coming from very poor backgrounds, and they see baseball as an escape of poverty. And governments do nothing. In Venezuela, it used to be a little bit different when I wrote this book, like in 2002. Right now, baseball is also a way out of poverty and out of the country because all the turmoil recently. So in that environment, if you are 11 or 12, you are getting pressure from your family to play baseball. You are getting pressure from society to play baseball. You give out education and everybody sees that as a good thing. And you tell these kids that only 2 will make it out of 100, and they could care less about that. And baseball is offering this opportunity to these kids in Latin America, but it's also creating a social problem in Latin America. And because nobody really cares what happened with these kids when they fail. There is no program. MLB has no program for them. The government have no program for them. They have no education. They have to go back to their country if they do that. Some stay in the U.S. And so it's tricky, right? Like,
yes.
There is not an easy answer of how to increase. Like, they sign around 600 Latin American players every year, every July the 2nd. Around 450 in the Dominican Republic, and about 200, it's around 700, because it's around 250 in Venezuela. And people say, well, the Latin American is great, they're all free agents, and they don't talk about the other side of the story. And for me, that's the most important part of the story. This whole system starts when they are, again, 11 or 12. So by 15, they're signed, but unofficially. So if, and then officially when they are 16 on July the 2nd. So if you, if they didn't see you in those 4 years before you were 16, you, if you didn't participate in the tryouts, and the scout never saw you playing it because you were not good enough. So if you're not signed by 16, then you, they start the problem, right? Like when you're 17, maybe you have a shot, maybe, if your body develop a little bit between the six, between your 16 and 17. But by 18, it's just you are too old for them. It's not working. And these kids, when they are 14 or 15, they are giving performance enhancing drugs to so they develop faster. And when they do these tryouts at 15, they're monsters. And MLB knows that. But they only test these players 6 months before they sign. So the Buscones know how to operate on under those circumstances, and they keep doing that. So maybe that's the reason, but the way they approach the, that business is not the right way. So,
well, again, because it's not the way they approach doing business with Japan, right? And it's because if I want to go sign Ichiro again, not only do I have to pay Ichiro, I have to pay his team. If I want to sign Uehara, Tanaka, even Kawasaki, I have to pay their team for the permission to talk to them because the team put money into developing these guys. And again, but if I want to sign a kid from Venezuela, I don't have to pay your favorite team, Tiburones. I don't have to pay them, right? But Tiburones might have helped develop this guy. Thanks, Tiburones. We'll take it from here. You know, and that's what happened to the major leagues. And when I look at Cuba and the normalizing of relations between the United States and Cuba, what I'm really interested to see is where this group of players fits in to among sources of major league talent, and how Major League Baseball deals with the Cuban National Series, with these teams. Do they pay these teams? Because again, the Cuban regime has put what little money they have and what time and effort they have into developing these guys. So does Major League Baseball pay these teams a posting fee? Or do they just say, well, you escape, you get out, or relations are normal now, but you leave there, you join some academy, and we'll pick you up for a price that's convenient for us, but not a price that fairly compensates the person who developed you for us. You know, in a more equitable system, the first thing you would do is not sign kids at 16. You'd sign them at 18, right? Then you have a better idea of where these guys are compared to American guys. And also, you don't, it eliminates so much of the age doping. Right? Because yeah. Players are just, well, how old are you? How old do you need me to be? Well, that's how old I am.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's this idea, if you're not everything you're going to be at 16, then you're over the hill. Like, that was what happened to Bautista. Like, he got to 18, and they were like, okay, you suck. You're 18. You're not a superstar yet. Forget you. And you wound up showing up at junior college, and duh, he was a late bloomer. You know what? Those things happen. They exist.
Yeah. And the first one who started to change identity and ages were the scouts. And they were doing in probably a good faith because they realized that there were this 18-year-old kid who was a good talent, but they could not sell that kid to the management. So they had to start lying about their ages and identity. Then the Buscones, and then these people say, well, if they are doing it, we can do it as well. But the reality is that they're doing because of pressure. By 18, they are garbage. So they have to be 16 to sign. The problem is that then when we learn about those lies many years after that, we blame the player, right? You lie.
Right.
But nobody blames the system. You know, that pushed this kid to lie when he's 18.
How dare you lie about your age by 2 years to get a $3 million contract? Listen to me. If someone comes in here with a wheelbarrow full of $3 million, I will tell them my name is Arturo Marcano. Give me the money.
That was the Toronto Star's Morgan Campbell and ESPN Deportes' Arturo Marcano. We'll post some links to both of their work in the show notes of this podcast, including one for Arturo's excellent book, Stealing Lives. Okay, it's time for the seventh inning stretch here at Pitch Talks, but stick around because we're going to be right back after this. It's time for your weekly pitch plug. Here at Homestand Sports, we're gearing up for a busy March and April. We've sold out our biggest show yet, Pitch Talks, on April 7th at the Phoenix Concert Theater in Toronto, featuring Jays president Mark Shapiro. And for other intimate talks on sports, we'll be hosting Puck Talks on March 23rd in Toronto, March 24th in Ottawa, and March 28th in Brooklyn, New York. We also have a Hoop Talks in Toronto coming up soon on March 9th. Use the promo code HOOPFAN, one word, lowercase, for $5 off. And finally, we have another Pitch Talk show on April 28th in Tavistock, Ontario. Head on over to homestandsports.com for more info and tickets. Welcome back to Pitch Talks. We continue now with the Toronto Star's Morgan Campbell and his take on how Latino players are treated in the media. He gives us his own baseball writing origin story and how it dovetailed into a deeper conversation about race and baseball.
And I came to baseball, I was a bit of an outsider. I was not a baseballish guy at all. And like my boss, when he hired me for the job, he kept warning me, you know, that baseball has a culture. There's a culture. And his voice would really go down half an octave when he said this. There's a culture of baseball that you don't understand. This kind of thing, right? But being that I didn't come from this baseball culture, I made an effort to use the tools I did have. And one of the things that I did have was the ability to hablar español, to speak Spanish. And that enabled me to get into parts of the locker room that a lot of guys couldn't get into and get stories, you know, that a lot of other guys couldn't get. One of the things I really took an interest in on a lower level was, you know, how these Latin American players from these different places in Latin America kind of fit in within the teams, but also how they're portrayed in the media. And also kind of this intersection of multiculturalism and media literacy and baseball. Three different incidents, issues, you know, kind of really crystallized these issues for me. So I remember my second year covering Major League Baseball, Jays series. I bet you some of you guys remember this series, remember this game. This was like around beginning of July 2010. Jays are in Yankee Stadium. And this game goes to extra innings, right? And this is a season two. Edwin Encarnacion is the second. It's his first full season with the Blue Jays. He's playing like trash defensively. And he's getting ripped in the media every week because he's a very poor defensive baseball player, let's face it. As far as third base is concerned and making the throw across the diamond, that was his biggest nemesis. But somehow, his inability, you know, to throw this baseball across the diamond transforms into like a bigger character deficiency. And this is one of the things, you know, we're going to address, is like how when dealing with certain players from certain ethnic groups, flaws in your game somehow become flaws in your character. And I don't know why this happens. So Edwin Encarnacion, Adam Lind is on first base. And Cito Gaston, I don't know why, calls for a sacrifice bunt with Edwin Encarnacion. And I love Cito. And this is what amazed me too, is that the post-game scorn didn't come to, and I love Cito, post-game scorn didn't come to Cito. Edwin Encarnacion hits this bunt down the third baseline, and he watches it to see if it's going to go foul. He's standing there in the batter's box watching this bunt to see if it's going to go foul. Ball doesn't go foul. Third baseman, I can't remember. Some of you probably remember who was playing third base for the Yankees at the time. I don't. Picks the ball up. Edwin Encarnacion jumps up because he sees this guy's picked up the ball. It hasn't gone foul. Sprints down the first baseline. Third baseman picks up this ball, throws it to second. Lynn's out. Back to first. Encarnacion's out. I don't know if it was the end of the game, but the Jays were down to the last out. That, for all intents and purposes, was the end of the game. After the game, all the focus is on Edwin Encarnacion and why he wasn't hustling on the sacrifice bunt. They asked Cito. Cito's furious. Yeah, man, he wasn't hustling. This guy needed to hustle. And afterward, you know, the reporters, this horde of reporters, this mob, this traveling scrum with the recorders extended, they descend on Edwin Encarnacion. He's doing up his shirt. He's got like this bright pink shirt, these white pants, and he looks startled because he turns around. He looks startled. He's got all this sweat. You know, and his English ain't that great.
And all these people are asking him about why he wasn't hustling. And he's there saying, oh, yeah, maybe I should have hustled. Speaks really quietly. Maybe I should have hustled. Yeah, I should have run harder. So I'm there with my tape recorder extended, digital recorder extended. We don't use tape anymore. Digital recorder extended. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. The hell did we get here? How do we get to the point where a baseball player is having to apologize for making an out on a sacrifice bunt? You guys tell me how that works. If that play unfolds according to plan, the guy bunting the ball is out. That's why it's a sacrifice. Now, I know I've been accused again of not being baseballish enough, but some of you guys, that's how it works, no? For some reason, all the blame is on Edwin Encarnacion when the guy who was supposed to go from first base to second base on the sacrifice bunt is out. Yet no one's accusing him of not hustling. How does this work? How do we get here? So how that relates to baseball is that Latin American players, black players, some guys with any mixture of melanin and Latino heritage get saddled with this phrase, lack of hustle, right? So this is what we kept hearing in the locker room after Edwin Encarnacion somehow got out on a sacrifice bunt. I'm like, how the hell did we get here? But we get here because these it's somewhere between an archetype and a stereotype, right? I'm not going to accuse all my colleagues of blindly subscribing to stereotypes, but it is kind of a platform or a catapult that helps you leap to the easy conclusion. The easy conclusion there is that Edwin Encarnacion wasn't hustling, even though Adam Lind clearly was not hustling. And Adam Lind, I should remember, everyone's got these microphones in Encarnacion's face. Sweat is running down his forehead, and Adam Lind is just in the corner putting a shirt on, and he just leaves. Right? He doesn't have to face any of the scrutiny. And again, I wrote my story in a way that kind of spread the blame around because I couldn't bring myself to, you know, blame it on Edwin. But again, that was kind of a moment for me when a lot of these things crystallized. So fast forward now, 2 years. Yunel Escobar comes to the ballpark, takes the field, and is eye black. One side says, tú eres. The other side says, maricón, right? And if you speak Spanish, the word maricón is translated to English. It's an anti-gay slur. In English, it would start with the word F and with the word T. It's something that that homophobes say to homosexuals. It's not something, you know, that clearly belongs on a baseball player's face. Or on a t-shirt. So predictably, a poop storm ensues. And so what happens is, you know, while we're talking about leaping to easy conclusions, what's the first easy conclusion to draw? Yonel Escobar is the worst homophobe on the planet. It gets to the point, and it got to the point in this incident where you didn't even need Escobar. We're not talking about Escobar anymore. I'm just a columnist talking about how great I am because I'm not a homophobe. Right? Like, why do we want credit for being things that we're not supposed to be in the first place? But this is what happens with Escobar. And you guys remember the news conference afterwards? 30 minutes of the most awkward question and answer ever, right? And now this guy becomes, trying to think of the word, like, piñata is too cliche, but scapegoat, sacrificial lamb, all the cliches you want to use. And strangely, the other thing he says in this news conference, you know, Escobar, is that, because they asked him, well, what does the word mean? What does the word mean? He's like, oh, maricón, it's a word without meaning. You know, we just use it so much. It can mean anything. It's the way, you know, like a lot of young people, black kids, white kids talk about the N-word. Well, we use it so much, we don't mean it the way you guys meant it back then. Now, this is not to say Yunel Escobar was right to do this, because whatever that word means, we know what it can mean, and everyone is kind of cognizant of that. And so it doesn't mean he's right for doing that, but it's funny because he says it's a word without meaning, and then all these gringos say, no, it's not. This is what it means. I mean, how did we get here? And it's funny, it made me think of, and I wonder, well, does he have a point? But when Escobar says, maricón means something else, and what you're trying to tell me it means, we say, shut up, what do you know? Now, again, I could be wrong again, just like I might have been wrong about the guy getting out on the sacrifice bunt. I could be wrong again. But if you're going to ask me, who knows more about contemporary Caribbean Spanish? The guys at Sportsnet or the guy from Havana? And I got to make this choice. Who knows more about contemporary Caribbean Spanish? The guy from Sportsnet or the guy from Havana who lives in Miami, who hangs around Cubans and Dominicans and Venezuelans all day? I'm going to choose him. Again, this is not to say he was right, but it is to say when he said the word doesn't mean what you think it means, it has a point. And to me, the way these things play out in the media, and I think in this situation in particular, we missed an opportunity for some richer and more nuanced storytelling, you know, that this hot take culture that we live in doesn't really make room for it, sadly. But again, I'm sitting here watching, you know, all of these gringos, American gringos, Canadian gringos, telling us that this Cuban guy doesn't mean what he says he meant in Spanish. And I'm just thinking to myself, what the hell happened? How did we get here? His name is Scott Miller, CBS Sports. He said, well, Yasiel Puig needs to get a grip before the Dodgers lose theirs. And I'm thinking, this is a team full of grown men, and you're telling me this one guy has been on the team for 2 months, whatever grip he's allegedly losing is going to cause all these grown men, these multimillionaires, to lose their grip. But the thing that really stood out about that column was near the top, you know, he paints this hypothetical scenario whereby Yasiel Puig's inability to hit the cutoff man, you know, costs the Dodgers a big game, right? But they lose this game and they miss the playoffs, but Yasiel Puig, because he's so selfish Yasiel Puig, back to the column, is going to leave his team in the lurch, go back to South Beach, and join a conga line. A conga line, right? So again, these three things come together. It's all in the same summer, and I'm like, yeah. Now how the hell did we get here to the point where we can write conga line unironically in a story about a Cuban baseball player? Let's start with the conga line. Now, that's not as bad as back in the Roberto Clemente days when they used to quote him phonetically in the paper. I play good gang. It's not as bad as doing that, but that's about as racist as you're allowed to get without losing your job or at least being kicked off of Twitter for 2 months. There's a few things, you know, that each of these three incidents, you know, make really clear. One of them is just this minefield, this media minefield, that a lot of African American and Latino and Afro-Latino players, you know, have to navigate, because when you deal with the media, you don't know how beholden these guys are, but a lot of them are, to these tropes, to these stereotypes, to these archetypes of what you're supposed to be. And now everything you do, for Puig, for Escobar, to a certain extent for Encarnacion, but not so much anymore because everyone loves him because he hits 40 home runs, you know, is viewed through these prisms, through the he's too lazy prism, through the he doesn't hustle prism, through the he's selfish prism. And it's a tough line to walk, right? Because if you're Edwin Encarnacion, you gotta hustle lest you be labeled lazy. But if you're Yasiel Puig and you hustle all the time, well, you're showing up your opponent. If you're Yunel Escobar, you steal third base with a 5-run lead, you're showing up your opponent. You're not respecting the game. Well, I thought I was supposed to hustle. You tell me what I should be doing. It also occurs to me, you know, two of these guys, you know, who've been lightning rods for this are Cuban. It occurs to me, too, that Cuban players are now what Negro League players coming to Major League Baseball were in the late 40s and early 50s, because they're a group of guys that are different. They're distinct from Dominican players who are brought in, and Venezuelan players who are brought into these Major League academies at 16, 17. These guys are more like Negro Leaguers in that they play in a separate league until they're good enough to play in the Major Leagues. But the thing keeping them out of the Major Leagues hasn't been skill. It's been politics. So their presence in the league, and again, I can't speak for everyone, but it seems to me that their presence in the league, you know, challenges a lot of assumptions about Cuba versus the United States, about one style of play versus another, about communism versus capitalism. Are there solutions to this? Because I don't want to be the guy that just points out a bunch of problems, you know, and says, okay, here's the problems, bye, Well, you want solutions? Pay me again, then I'll come back and tell you the solutions. Diversity in the newsroom, diversity in the press box is important because it's important. Like, it's a self-evident priority. I know a lot of players talk about having translators because Japanese players, a lot of them have translators. A lot of Latin American players would like that, or more reporters that speak Spanish. The problem with that is, yo no tengo la más mínima idea dónde el Toronto Star sacaría un periodista así. Exactly. They said, I don't know where they would find a guy that speaks Spanish. I come and I talk about it. I talk the talk, and I do walk the walk, but it's not something I just woke up doing, right? It's something that I work on. It's something that I practice in my professional life. You know, and I keep a close eye just on how stories about different, that involve ethnicity, how they're written. How could it be better? How could it be worse? What's done well? What's not done well? Because it's a skill. It's a technique. You know, it's something that people have to work on. And to wrap up, because technique is paramount, we'll take any questions before I go to the conga line.
And that's the Pitch Talks podcast for this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you have a sec, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave some feedback and rate the thing. It would really help us out a lot in keeping this train wreck rolling. There's a new one coming out each and every Tuesday in this first season of Pitch Talks, so please subscribe. For more info on Pitch Talks, please truck on down to the mothership, homestandsports.com/pitch. And you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, where we are known as, you got it, Pitch Talks. I'm Kevin Hilliard. Good night, everybody. The Pitch Talks love theme is by Steve Kreklow at Kreklo on Twitter. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod, incompetech.com, incompetech.com. The Pitch Plug ad music by Zeus, courtesy of Arts and Crafts. Pitch Talks is a Homestand Sports production.